From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Film director, author, actor, impressionist Peter Bogdanovich is my guest this week. His films include They All Laughed, Nickelodeon, Paper Moon, Targets, The Last Picture Show, and What's Up, Doc? You've seen him recently as an actor on The Sopranos. Peter Bogdanovich has written extensively about the cinema, including books of his interviews with directors, Who the Devil Made It, and actors, Who the Hell's In It. His dead-on impressions include Howard Hawks, but since few people know what Hawks sounded like, we have to take his word for it. Peter Bogdanovich, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks, Gary. Nice to be here.
You're so versatile, an actor, director, screenwriter. How do you decide, what projects you're going to work on?
Well, my main gig is directing, writing and directing movies. And when there isn't a movie, or there's a pause between movies, I do something else. Or I sometimes do them concurrently. But it's in show business, unless you're Spielberg, I guess, you go where the wind blows a little bit. I've been a bit of a cork in the river. I think it was Renoir, Jean Renoir, said his father, the painter, said you have to be a cork in the river, but a smart cork.
Well, you do fine impressions. Is that something you could always do when you were a kid?
Yeah, I was famous for my Bugs Bunny impression in kindergarten and grade school, so everybody called me Bugs. My nickname until I finished high school was Bugs.
a lot of people made a living doing impressions. Did you ever think of doing a nightclub act and doing all
this? No, the closest I got to it was I auditioned for CBS at one point and did a monologue, which was not very funny. At least they didn't laugh. I was very young. I was a teenager.
You started your career as an actor.
Yeah, I started as an actor with studying, at the American Academy of Dramatic Art in the teenage classes on Saturday mornings. And that got me a job as an apprentice in Michigan on a summer season of summer theater. And then I started studying with Stella Adler, and for 4 years I studied with her for 4 full years, took all her courses. That was amazing.
Did you meet Marlon Brando when he was there?
I met Marlon Brando on my own by accident a couple of times, but I did share Stella with Marlon. We talked about her a few times.
Yeah.
At some point, at the time I was about 19, decided I wanted to direct in the theater, and that's the first thing I directed was in the 59-60 season. I was 20. I did a production of Clifford Odets' The Big Night.
That was off-Broadway?
Yeah.
So theater directing, was that, preceded your desire to direct films?
No, I think it was an attempt to, I hoped I'd be discovered as a brilliant theater director and that they'd hustle me off into movies. Didn't it work out that way? Yeah, best laid plans. I actually got into movies because Roger Corman recognized my name from having written a few pieces for Esquire and said, you're a writer. And I said, yeah, would you like to write a movie? And then that's how I got to work on The Wild Angels, which is the first film I worked on.
You were one of the writers on that picture?
I rewrote the whole script.
Uh-huh.
Got no credit and got $300.
$300 was a lot of money?
No. But Roger remembered that I'd done a lot of work on it, and I became his assistant on the picture and ended up directing the second unit. And he was impressed with what I did, so he gave me the opportunity to direct my own first picture, Targets, with Boris Karloff.
Well, so what was that like to work with Karloff? I mean, you must have admired his work since he had been in the pictures
of
your idol.
Well, he'd been in a lot of pictures, and he was a lovely man. He was a real pro. He was 79, and he had emphysema and braces on both legs, but you couldn't stop a trooper. I only worked with him 5 days, but that's all we had him for.
Really?
Yeah.
How long did you spend on the picture?
23.
Oh, I see. So you worked around him the rest of the time.
Well, we shot all his stuff in 5 days somehow.
How did that lead to the last picture show?
The producers of the last picture show, Bert Schneider and Bob Rafelson and Steve Blauner, BBS, saw Targets, and I had a meeting with them, and they said they'd like to do anything I'd be interested in doing, I should bring to them. They were impressed with Targets, so I sent them the novel of the last picture show, and they said, yeah, let's do it, and it was very simple, that was it. They just had to get the rights from somebody else, and they did, and we made it.
Yeah, and you used a lot of unknown actors, or inexperienced actors, I guess, in the last picture show. What were the advantages of that over, say, movie stars in the picture?
Well, first of all, we couldn't afford movie stars, but even if we could, the plan was a very inexpensive picture. It only cost $1.3 million, and I was $300,000 over budget. So it was supposed to be a $1 million picture. But the whole idea was to use new people and make that kind of movie where you use an unknown cast, essentially. And that was always the plan. We never thought about using stars. We did think about it. There was a talk about Jimmy Stewart playing the Sam the Lion part. There was talk about Vera Miles playing playing Sybil's mother.
Mm-hmm.
But at a certain point, I decided that having one star would throw the whole thing off. So we decided to have no stars. The closest we got to a star was Ben Johnson, who
was a co-star.
He was not a star, but he was a somewhat familiar character actor.
If you'd seen a lot of Westerns, then you knew who he was.
Yeah.
Was there any objection to you making that picture in black and white?
I thought there would be, but there wasn't. I proposed to the producers that we do it in black and white, and Bert Schneider said, why? And I said, well, I think that the period is going to be much easier to capture and convey in black and white. And then I think, as Orson Welles said, black and white helps actors to give better performances.
Why do you think that's so?
Well, Orson used to say it was the actor's friend, because every performance, he said, looks better in black and white. He went on to say, name me a great performance in color, I defy you. But I don't know why it is, but it is true. It seems to ground the performance and makes it more real. I don't know, because black and white is an abstraction, but it seems to make it more real.
Mm-hmm.
I guess because you remove the distractions like hair color, eye color, skin color. You just focus on you can't be distracted by irrelevant things like what color the eyes are or something like that. I think that helps.
I try so hard, my dear, to show that you were my every dream. Yet you're afraid each thing I do is just some evil scheme. A memory from your lonesome past.
I might be wrong, but I think that The Last Picture Show was one of the first films to use existing music rather than a score. Was that your decision to use records?
Was that my decision? Yeah. I had done the same thing in a much less elaborate way in my first picture in Targets. We couldn't afford a score or records. But I had a friend who had produced some records, and he gave me 5 45s and said, you can use anything you want on there. It costs us $5,000. And that was where the idea came to use music as a sound effect rather than as music. And so that's what I did in Targets. And then when I came to Last Picture Show, I had liked the way it kind of creates another world, creates a kind of complexity to the scene, particularly if the music is counterpoint to this. to the scene itself. In other words, instead of scoring the scene, you kind of do the music, you use the music as a kind of counterpoint to create another world that's going on within the scene. I think the most drastic use of that was at the end of the last picture show, where there's this very emotional scene between Cloris Leachman and Tim Bottoms, and she throws the coffee and yells at him, and then they make up. And in the background, you hear this very corny comedy record.
Right.
With the people laughing and stupid music and so on. That was an extreme example of what I'm talking about.
We're talking with Peter Bogdanovich. We just recently watched the last picture show at the together at the Golden State Festival Film Festival in Monterey. Well, is that the same film that people saw in 1971? How is that film different than it was then?
It's coming out on DVD again in a cleaned up print at the end of this month. It's different by about 6 minutes.
You've tinkered with it some.
I added 6 minutes to it that I always felt was needed.
Uh huh.
And we cleaned up the sound and cleaned up the picture, but it's essentially the same movie. It's just 6 minutes longer.
Have you cut anything?
No.
What do you think about that? Do you think that's a good idea? I mean, obviously you do because you did it, but I mean, do you think directors should tinker with their movies?
Well, I think if you've been bothered by something and you have a chance to fix it, yeah. I mean, my father was a painter, and he used to say, no painting is ever finished.
Uh-huh.
And Robert Graves had the same thought, who said, no poem is ever perfect. So, I think no picture is ever perfect or finished in a way. But when you do the best you can, and you don't have any interference, and you finish it the way you want to, you might be able to do it better, but there's nothing more you can do.
Yeah,
I had that experience with a number of pictures where I mean, maybe I could do it better, but I can't do it in this lifetime, I can't.
Right, right. You did the best you could.
So Paper Moon and What's Up Doc and Targets and Daisy Miller. And
when you see them now, you think, oh, I wish I could do this.
No, I don't really. It'd be pointless.
Mm-hmm.
Either you leave it alone or you want to redo the whole thing. But other pictures where you feel that you've compromised or it wasn't exactly the way you wanted it or whatever, then I'm very happy to go back. Or pictures where the scenes have been cut, like Mask, for example.
Oh, right.
I added 8 minutes and put the Springsteen music back that had been taken out, and I timed the color correctly, that it had been mistimed by way too bright.
So people who see Mask on DVD will see a true
version.
They'll
see the version that I intended 20 years ago and didn't succeed in having it done.
So
that was a big one to fix.
Did you have more freedom on the last picture show than any other picture that you made?
No. No, I didn't have a lot. I mean, I had freedom.
Uh-huh.
But I always argued with them, but I thought it was too short when it came out. I thought we were about 6 minutes too short.
Uh-huh.
And
so you've added 6 minutes.
I went and added 6 minutes when I was allowed to, when I finally could do it. No, I had more freedom on Doc and Paper Moon and
uh-huh.
Daisy Miller, St. Jack. They all laughed. Those were completely autonomous.
You also collaborated with Larry McMurtry, correct me if I'm wrong, but on a treatment for Lonesome Dove, that was going to be a film that you were going to do?
No, that was the film that we were going to do. It wasn't the treatment, it was a screenplay.
Oh, uh-huh, so you actually had a screenplay?
Oh, full-length screenplay, yeah.
Who was going to be in it?
It was written for John Wayne, Jimmy Stewart, Henry Fonda, Ben Johnson, Sybil Shepherd, Cloris Leachman, Ellen Burstyn, Ben Johnson, I said.
What happened?
It was a huge picture.
Why didn't we get it?
Larry and I worked on it together for a few months, and he would write pages, and then I would cut them down or make them more into screenplay form and edit. But he wrote a 350-page screenplay, which I cut down to about 150 pages. And Duke Wayne turned it down. Jimmy Stewart said okay, Fonda said okay, but Duke didn't want to do it. And it's kind of an end of the West Western, Pete, and I'm not ready to hang up my spurs yet. But you don't die in it. No, but everybody else does.
So Duke was going to be which character then? Call?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would have been a great movie.
It would have been a great movie, yeah. The person who told him to turn it down was John Ford.
Why did he tell him to turn it down?
Well, he didn't want him to do it with me. It was too much. He was on his deathbed, and I mean, he helped me get Ben Johnson, but he wasn't going to give me Duke Wayne.
That was his guy.
That was his guy. He wasn't going to give me on his deathbed. He wasn't going to give John Wayne to some goddamn slob.
Could you have gotten Glenn Ford or somebody to do it?
I didn't want to do it with anybody else. I said, if we can't get John Wayne, Jimmy Stewart, and Henry Fonda, I don't want to do it. And I said to Larry, why don't you write it as a novel? And 13 years later, he did, and won the Pulitzer Prize.
It's a wonderful story.
Well, yeah, it started out as a Western for me. I got Warners to pay him some money to write an original, and we worked out the story and who was going to be in it and what was going to happen, and he started writing. Wonderful stuff, and then I would rewrite it and send it back to him, and we worked like that until we got a script. And then he eventually went back to Warners and bought it back from Warners and wrote the novel.
Speaking of we're talking about director's cuts of the movies and so forth. What did you think of someone else recutting Touch of Evil?
Well, I'm the one who found that memo.
Mm-hmm.
Charlton Heston gave it to me when I was preparing a book on Orson, which came out
92.
Called This is Orson Welles. And I thought it was an interesting idea. They didn't do it very well. I thought they made a few mistakes. Unfortunately, there was no filmmaker involved. They didn't even tell me they were doing it because they didn't want me to get any credit for it.
I see. They didn't.
Academics tend to be even more greedy than regular people. I thought it was. I didn't think they did it right. The opening without the music was a mistake. But they did. It was okay.
In the audio commentary that you did on Citizen Kane, you said that you didn't think Kane was Welles' best picture. What do you think is Welles' best picture?
Well, I mean, it's certainly a great film, and I don't mean to denigrate it. It's just I think there was never a confluence of all those elements that make it that where Orson had complete control, and he never had that as much, plus all the technical apparatus at his disposal again. He thought Chimes of Midnight was his best film, and it's a great film. It's hard to argue that Kane isn't his best film, because the rest of them are so hard to see.
Yeah.
But Othello's pretty great, and Chimes of Midnight, and I love Touch of Evil.
Well, in
Amberson's, I think, probably would have been a greater film if it had been his version.
If he'd gotten a chance.
As it is, the first hour is extraordinary.
The Mercury Theater, on the air. Columbia Broadcasting System takes pleasure in bringing you the 12th in its series of weekly broadcasts featuring Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air. Tonight, Broadway's and radio's most celebrated theatrical producing company brings to life the best-loved character in detective fiction, the immortal Sherlock Holmes. The play is Orson Welles' own adaptation for radio of William Gillette's enduring melodrama based on the famous stories by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Before the performance begins, here is the director of the Mercury Theater, the star and producer of these unique broadcasts, Orson Welles.
Good evening. Well, tonight it's back to Baker Street. Back to that unlikely London of the 19th century where high adventure awaits all who would seek it, in a hansom cab or under a gas lamp in an Inverness cape. For tonight we pay tribute to the most wonderful member of that most wonderful world, a gentleman who never lived, and who will never die.
You also mentioned how much radio influenced his filmmaking. You were a fan of radio also when you were growing up?
Yeah, well, radio was dying as I was growing up. As I reached my teens, radio was over, pretty much. But I was privileged to hear dramatic radio and comedy radio, you know, when I was about 6, 7, until I was about 10.
And you saw...
I loved radio.
And you saw a ton of movies. You loved the movies, of course.
Yeah, well, but radio was my first love, as it was Orson's.
Uh-huh.
Well, I think theater was his first love, but he loved radio, and he did. I would say one of the sad things about our culture is that it's so disposable, and Orson Welles did some of his greatest work in radio, and nobody's ever heard it. And it's extraordinary. It should be available, but nobody be interested, but it is amazing work. It's as great as some of his movies, some of the radio he did.
Before and after War of the Worlds. I guess that's the one that everyone
heard. Yeah, he always used to, I asked him about War of the Worlds. Well, we always used to think that was one of our lesser shows.
Well,
and it was. I mean, what he did with the Apple Tree, Galt with the Apple Tree, or Oscar Wilde's The Happy Prince, or those are two that come to mind that are amazing.
When he did the War of the Worlds, he knew exactly what he was doing, right?
Oh, sure.
You know,
he had ripped off the idea from a Spanish radio show, the idea of simulating newscasts.
Mm-hmm.
And as he put it, the guy in Spain went to jail. I didn't go to jail. I went to Hollywood. And he, you know, I mean, that show was a sensation. Scared half the country and made him a star and a popular star. It was only after the War of the Worlds that they got a sponsor. They didn't have a sponsor before. The show was a sustaining show, meaning the network paid for it.
And then it was Campbell Soup or
Campbell
something?
Campbell Soup. Yeah. It became the Campbell Playhouse. Mm-hmm. Went from being the Mercury Theater on the air to the Campbell Playhouse.
Well, you know, you have an entire book of your interviews with Welles, and you have this book I mentioned, Who the Devil Made It, your interviews with directors. What did you learn from interviewing directors that you didn't learn from watching their films?
Oh, wow, a lot. I mean, learned a lot. A lot of things that I use all the time, just talking to them and getting to know them, seeing them working. Things about geography in movies, how you can create your own geography. I learned from Howard Hawks, or how it's not a good idea to rehearse action, how it's not a good idea to rehearse dramatic scenes.
Well, you don't rehearse when you...
Not a dramatic scene, not a big dramatic scene like the end of a picture show. Or
how do you just start the cameras and rolling?
You just say, do it.
Yeah.
Because if it's a big and dramatic scene, a person has to cry and yell and all that. You don't want to waste it doing a rehearsal. Because it's the first time they do it is what's going to be the best time they do it. If they're any good, they're probably going to do it best right away.
So you just trust you got the right actor to do it.
Yeah, and you don't do it first thing. You don't do it early on in the shoot.
Talking with film director Peter Bogdanovich.
Hitchcock didn't like to talk to his actors or tell them anything. Are you the same? Or?
That's not true.
No?
He liked to say that, but I saw him directing actors.
One of my guests here had done a biography of Doris Day, and he said that Doris was very upset while making The Man Who Knew Too Much that he hadn't told her anything. She said, "Don't you like what I'm doing?" He said, if I didn't like it, I would have said something or something.
Yeah, that's often true, is praise by through silence.
Uh-huh.
Hitch wasn't garrulous with the actors, but he did direct them, and he had a kind of a pretty pleasant mood on the set. I watched him direct with the birds.
Oh, yeah?
For a few days, and he was fun to be around on the set. I watched him direct Topaz, which he didn't like particularly, but he was into it.
It's an interesting film, Topaz. I like it a lot. It's kind of a movie about color.
Yeah. I watched him direct Torn Curtain, too.
Oh, uh-huh.
He didn't get along with Paul.
That has at least one great scene. But that's also the film where he had his falling out with Bernard Herrmann, right?
Yeah.
What happened there, do you know?
Hitch wanted not a dark score, and Benny Herrmann wrote a dark score, and Hitch got furious.
Hmm.
But I think he didn't like the picture, and he was worried about it.
Yeah.
And he I think, wanted to have a score that was counterpoint to the movie, but, you know, it wasn't a good score he ended up with.
No.
Wasn't a great score.
There's a few scenes that have no score at all, though you really would think, oh, a Bernard Herrmann score would be great here.
Yeah.
We've been talking with Peter Bogdanovich, the director of Mask, The Last Picture Show, Paper Moon, What's Up Doc, and many other great films. He's also an actor and the author of many books, including his book of interviews with actors entitled Who the Hell's In It? We'll hear more of my discussion with Peter Bogdanovich on the next From the Bookshelf. That's all for this edition of From the Bookshelf, but I'll be back again next week with another great program. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org. As always, thanks to our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her help. Thanks, Breanne. For KUSP and From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.